Welcome to the Theorist-Composer Collaboration, a podcast interview series highlighting modern composers and their compositions. My name is Aaron DiZarrilla. I'm the host of this podcast and also a graduate music theory student at Florida State University. Today I will be talking with the composer Catherine Bergman, who, alongside her piece Land of Cloud-Tinted Waters, is the featured guest for this episode. We discuss her background, evoking natural landscapes, field research, writing for percussion ensembles, composing for both educational and professional settings, and much more. So, without further ado, this is an excerpt from Land of Cloud-Tinted Waters, and welcome to the TCC. Again, the music that you were just listening to is an excerpt from the piece titled Land of Cloud-Tinted Water by the composer Catherine Bergman, who, alongside her music, is the featured guest for this episode. That leads me to welcome Catherine Bergman themselves to the program. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, of course. Very happy to have you on. Catherine, how about you go ahead and tell the audience about yourself, personally, professionally, academically, whatever you choose.
Okay, sure. So I'm a composer of music for concert band, orchestra, and chamber ensembles, including quite a bit for percussion, which we'll dig into a bit today. Much of my work is inspired or explores nature and landscape and the environment, and sometimes the intersection between art and science. I live in Minnesota, so naturally a lot of my landscape and ecological music focuses on the landscapes of the upper Midwest. And again, we'll talk about some of that today.
Very cool. You know, I've always joked, you know, with my girlfriend, because we are both from Florida and both from the same high school and so on. I mean, I've lived in a handful of places. I told you in the preliminary that I spent a handful of years as a kid in Muskegon, Michigan, which is right outside of Grand Rapids, and grew up a little bit in Chicago, though I was so young, I don't remember that at all. But I've spent most of my life in the South, born in Texas, some years in Atlanta, Georgia, and then down in Bradenton, Florida for almost all of it. And I've always joked with my girlfriend that that we must go above the Mason-Dixon line, because I love Love the nature, the atmosphere, not to mention the weather. I know that winter is something undesirable sometimes, but just oh man, to see mountains again. I mean, Tennessee mountains are absolutely beautiful, the Appalachian Mountains, but to see, rolling landscapes, large open fields, snowy fields, I wish for it one day, hopefully.
Yeah, you'll have to come and visit sometime.
Yeah, what does it get in the winter typically?
I mean, generally, like it sits around like the teens, you'd say, for like on average temperature in a day. But we have a lot of single digits and some days below zero, and sometimes we get a lot of snow. Last year was an actually really weird winter. We got hardly any snow, and it was really warm. I say we really didn't even have winter last year, and I was bummed because I actually really like winter, which is it's a good thing because I live in the right place for it. But I also really like to cross country ski, and so we didn't have any snow, and it was just devastating. I really hope that we get a real winter this year.
Oh, sure. Well, real winter for down here is the absolute coldest it gets is maybe 25, and that's at like midnight. A peak temperature winter day in Florida, at least northern Florida where I am right now, it's probably like 35. That's like the lowest the peak will get. And of course the summer's plus 100, but I know it actually can get pretty warm up there. I'm kind of surprised by how warm it can get up in the Midwest. But that's not just to do pedantic small talk about the winter, but I absolutely, or about the weather, but I absolutely love the imagery and the landscapes of the Midwest and particularly the northern Midwest, exactly where you are, in fact. And we'll talk about when we get into the specific movements and the different landmarks that you wrote the movements about, but I have a particular affinity for them, even if I've never been there or not really. So, okay. You write for a handful of different ensembles, which carry with it timbre, and you have a particular speciality with the percussion, which is quite interesting. But further than the ensemble, maybe, how would you describe your music generally?
Sure. I say I take some influence from minimalism and post-minimalism. I feel like the topic or concept of the music influences me more than anything, really, when I'm writing. I rarely write music for music's sake. I almost always have something that I'm trying to evoke in the piece specifically. And sometimes that comes out in a lot of different ways. And I also, as a composer, don't shy away from writing for young musicians, which we had talked about a bit in the pre-conversation. I write music for band a lot, and there aren't a lot of professional bands. There's most band music is happening in the schools, whether that be from elementary school through college. And I think it's really important to have a strong foundation in music right away, playing good music and music that is designed to be, educational, yet also artistically interesting. So I think that's really important.
Oh, it certainly is. It certainly is. I mean, I'm only 20. I had to think for a second. I'm only 23, which that saying that's going to become less and less significant as it goes on. But not very long ago, I was playing that exact kind of music, or at the very least, thinking about it. And yes, there is a lot of trash out there when it comes to. I mean, there just is, and I think almost anyone. Honestly, most people can probably agree with that if they went through a mildly standard, especially public education. I had a beautiful, I was very fortunate with the zip code that I moved into, in that it had at least relative to the country, very well-funded music program. But even then, the instructors could only do so much. And I don't pin this on them, but a lot of the music was, let's say, not fantastic. And more than just it being kind of boring or maybe not as instructional as it could, I think a thing that you're getting at here, don't let me put words in your mouth, but is that it having high quality grade level music or music that is obtainable for those levels not only serves as a pedagogical purpose, but as preparatory in many ways. And so when
Totally.
you could have very difficult, cool sounding music for a high school that is not preparatory for what orchestra writing is really like or what band writing is really like.
Yeah, I think yeah, there's just a lot of room for more music for young people, and I try to make that happen a little bit.
Sure. And well, I want to come back to around to this in the later section, talking about the industry and talking about composition. In that, we're going to put a pin in this for right now. But what feels like the separation of composers who write for that, and then quote unquote serious composition, which, as anyone listening can tell right now, that's a little silly and in ways elitist. But we'll get to that later on, because clearly you're someone who has both feet firmly in each area and can do both. So let's get into the piece of today, which is Land of Cloud-Tinted Water. There are five movements to this piece, and there's a reason why we were talking about the landscape and the weather. Is, well, maybe not the weather so much with the piece, but the overall landscape vibe and environment of the upper Midwest, a very beautiful part of our country, has a lot to do with this piece. And if you don't mind, go ahead and give us some insight on the background and the framing of Land of Cloud-Tinted Water.
Yeah, so starting with the title of the piece, the word Minnesota comes from the Dakota word for meaning land of cloud-tinted water or land of sky blue water. It's, loose translation, but that's what the title comes from. And so it's kind of like a translation back and forth for the word Minnesota. And it explores five different wilderness or nature areas throughout the state. I've done a lot of, camping, hiking, exploring throughout Minnesota, and there's a lot of variation in the landscape. And I just wanted to write a piece to kind of honor that and bring some of those ideas out through music. And so I chose five different areas and I visited all of them and did some research behind all of them. And I love writing for percussion, and there's just so much you can do with sounds and colors and textures that I thought it would be a great way to bring out those landscapes through that percussion trio, which is this piece is written for.
Let's go in with the hook at the end there, percussion trio. Now, what are I mean, you are clearly someone with many different skills, but like, what's your if you were to say primary instrument, well, what instrument family do you come from?
I come from the woodwind family, actually. I'm a saxophone player, and that's where my my love for band music comes from, because I've been sitting in the middle of a band since fifth grade. And percussion happens a lot in band too. I mean, that's a big part of wind band music, and I have just always been drawn to it, mostly since becoming a composer. Like I didn't think to be a percussionist like in fifth grade when you chose instruments, but at this point I just have so much respect for the variety of like talents that a percussionist has, because they have to play so many different instruments well. They do drums, they do xylophones, they do it all.
They do it all. And as someone who's a string player, a violinist, even to the level of saxophone, the thought that you would have to switch an instrument mid-piece for an auxiliary purpose or something of that sort is insane. It's just the nature of the instrument and the pedagogy. I'm not really sure it's a problem. It's just how it is with strings is like, violin's your thing. I can sub in on viola pretty easily, but that's an extra thing I went out of my way to obtain. That's not like part of the whole thing. Yes, the percussion ensemble, percussion family of instruments, and percussionists themselves, I find it mystical how they're able to do all of the things that they do, being able to be masters in all sorts of different things. As like a violinist, I'm like, oh, you play marimba. Well, like that might be their like thing, but they also can do everything else under the sun for the most part in the percussion family. So
Right.
why did you decide for this piece to go forward with, given one of the obvious answers is variety. As we've laid out with what we're saying, there's so much variety in what can be done, even with a small number of performers. But why percussion trio for this piece in particular?
Yeah, so I wrote it for a specific ensemble, the Minnesota Percussion Trio, and I knew the members of the group and they're all fabulous musicians, and I've been wanting to collaborate with them, and this seemed like the perfect opportunity to explore these sounds and these instruments and work with these players. So it all kind of just gelled.
Sure. And there's a special denotation in your score that said that you received an artist incentive grant in 2016 from the Minnesota State Arts Board, and that the creation of this piece was in line with that granted initiative. So can you talk a bit about that? That really jumped out to me.
Yeah, we're really lucky in Minnesota that we have a pretty well-funded arts and culture scene here. The state actually funds arts grants that are quite generous. They're not easy to get, but they are more plentiful than most other states. I had applied, I think, with this same application twice. The first time they were funding 10 of the applications, and I was the 11th in the line. And so I was like, okay, I'll try again. And the second time I got the grant, and so it funded all of my research, if you will. So like my visiting all of the places, and many of them I'd been to before, but I went with different intentions that time. And then also paying me for a commission fee, and also paying the artists and putting on performances of the piece. So it was a really fabulous grant to receive. And yeah, I think every state should be so lucky.
Yeah, I was about to say, as someone who mostly grew up in Florida, you're speaking a different language right now. there's many things to say about the state of Florida in that, but not in this conversation. One element that, although you can say whether or not it's like super integral, but one of the most unique parts, I think, of this piece, and it's in two different movements, is the direct usage, well, direct imitation of specific birds and specific sounds and melodies that they make, or shape of the sounds that they make. Two parts to this question. Why did you choose to implement it in the way that you did? And how did you go about, as you were saying, researching that?
Sure. So yeah, I have a few different bird songs throughout the piece, and reasons for including them is if I'm trying to evoke, a landscape or a soundscape, the animals and plants and geology, geography, all of the history of the place and the current state of it plays into that. And the soundscape itself, some of it is a direct imitation and some is more abstract. But the ones that really stuck out to me and felt iconic to the place, I did often want to imitate fairly verbatim. And I indicate in the score which species those are when they happen the first time, if they are direct imitations. And I also have a link in the score where the players can go hear those bird songs so they can try to emulate them through the music.
Yeah, see, that's the most I've seen birdsong imitated. Messiaen would do it. Some contemporaries I've have, but I've never seen someone link a recording to a specific species of bird. That's really cool.
Yeah, and actually there are different, like the same species of bird sometimes has different calls too. So it's like, okay, I've heard, for example, the white-throated sparrow. The ones in northern Minnesota have a different call than ones in other places. And I didn't know this. I was trying to identify what bird it was, and I was having a hard time finding the actual song because I didn't realize at the time that they're not all exactly the same. So linking to that and sharing exactly the song that I was hearing and that I wanted to portray through the music, because you can notate it, but it might not sound exactly the same, but if you have the player give them a chance to hear it too, then they might be able to tweak it a little bit and make it sound more like the real deal.
Sure. And so when researching it, did you physically go there, or was it many hours of looking at your browser?
No, I physically go there, and that is the case for any of my landscape music. I really don't feel comfortable writing a piece about a place I've never been. And when I do go, I usually take field recordings, and usually those don't, I don't usually write electroacoustic music. I have like one or two pieces, but usually those field co recordings don't end up in the music, but they can be a reminder of what I was feeling, what I was hearing, and also like when I'm trying to identify a bird or whatever it is I'm hearing. Then I can actually go back and listen. But also just like writing things down when I'm there, and sometimes I already know the species or whatever it may be. But that's one way I research.
Sure. You know, in my limited experience listening to new music, and I had, you know, I've always said this to people that the most fun concerts you can ever go to while you're at university, in my opinion, is not orchestra, it's not band, it's new music concerts, because you literally have no idea what you're walking into. And
Right.
I've listened to a lot of electric acoustic in live settings where it's surround sound, where it's meant to be atmospheric in the same way that your piece is. But it's just phenomenal to me that you have essentially no electric acoustic elements at all. There's no recordings, there's no nothing. And I've seen pieces that are begging at the same sort of thing that you are. But it's almost always with some other, I guess I'm going to call it a crutch almost. I can't imagine how at points it must have been frustrating trying to acoustically emulate all of these natural sounds with these different mediums. It's just, to me, that's wizardry almost to be able to do that.
I think it sounds, it's, I try to make it sound very organic in that way, but also give the performers liberty to make it, artistically their own. So that's one way that direct mimicry still has a little bit of leeway.
Sure. And so let's get into the movements and their names and their inspiration. And of course, there will be clips of them played within the episode to set the atmosphere. So let's go into movement one, which is it Voyageurs?
Yeah, so Voyageurs National Park is located on in the very north of Minnesota along the Canadian border, and it's really a huge, vast area of interconnected lakes. You could boat for, hundreds of miles in this area, and you'd be on lots of different lakes, but they're all kind of joined as one. And it's a really serene place, and this particular movement kind of tells the story of, if you're camping and you're waking up in the morning to the sounds of birds also waking up, and kind of the soundscape just growing and growing as the whole landscape comes to life.
Thank you. Well, when I say it's recognizable immediately in the recording, I'm not saying the instrument, but it's recognizable that there's just something different about the atmosphere, right from the get-go. And the instrument that you chose to illustrate what you just said is very unique, the ocarina. Which, forgive me, the only experience I have with the ocarina is the Zelda game, Ocarina of Time. I mean, really, and also maybe some like Instagram reels of someone playing the ocarina. But I'm not gonna say never have seen it, but it was, well, it's mystical. It really, it just, so is that technically a percussion instrument?
No, it's not. And first, I really like that you're using the word mystical because that is totally what I think of. So I use the ocarina to emulate the loon call. And the loon is actually the state bird of Minnesota, and they're somewhat endangered. I don't know if they're like technically on the endangered species list, but they have a threatened population. But they're just this really magical, mystical creature. And they have this long, kind of solemn call that they call back and forth to each other on the lakes, and they make another call that's a little bit more lively, but this is like their song rather than a call, and they communicate back and forth to one another with it. So you'll hear actually all three of the percussionists have their own ocarina. I had to teach them how to play it because no, it's not a percussion instrument. And I'm like, first thing on the piece, not a percussion instrument. And I'm a wind player, so I was able to help them with it a bit. And I actually have had some other ensembles play this piece that are like, yeah, I don't think our percussionists are gonna be successful at this. And so I actually recorded the ocarina part for them, and then they played like a recording in the performance, and I didn't hear the performance, so I don't know how that went, but I thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah, that is kind of funny. The almost at this point, 20, this will be 25 episodes in. Whenever I get pieces, ritualistically, I never look at the score first. I only do the audio files when I sit down, just to experience it as if I was an audience member. And like you said, percussion trio. Okay, let's go. Open it. Not a percussion. I'm like, okay, what's going on? Anyways. But it's a beautiful, like, sets the atmosphere. I was going to say it fancy, but it sets the atmosphere is essentially,
Sure.
yes, very beautiful. And so moving on to movement two, which is titled Superior for the Superior Hiking Trail. Can you talk about that environment a bit?
Yeah, so this piece is inspired by a view of Lake Superior from the Superior hiking trail along lots of different routes, but this specifically, so the Superior hiking trail goes all the way up and down the North Shore of Minnesota. And this particular spot that I was at that inspired the piece was at Split Rock Lighthouse State Park. And it was dusk, and I was sitting along the shore and watching not only the lake, but the sky and the reflection of the sky on the lake. And there were waves crashing ever so gently, but also the color of the sky changing over time slowly. Just had this really, I don't know, just like the magnitude of the size of this lake. It's the largest lake in the world by surface area. And thinking about that, and also just seeing this the beautiful colors that are happening in the scene. And that's kind of what I tried to portray through the music.
Beautiful. It's I'm listening to all these parks and these trails and what's around and so on. I'm thinking about the one national park that I grew up right next to, or the closest. Of course, the most famous one in Florida is the Everglades, but I'm quite a bit far away from that. The one place that I grew up in Bradenton, the closest national park was the Hernando de Soto National Park, which is where the conquistador Hernando de Soto landed before he went on his reign of terror and disease and mass murder throughout Florida. So I like your stories
So
better.
that's different.
Yeah, it is different. It's a beautiful little park. I have wonderful memories there, but I just the contrast in my head is like, this is what we have down here. Anyways. So yeah, movement
Absolutely.
to Superior. This is, as I said in my notes to you, it was surprising because, with atmospheric music like this, especially when someone is not familiar with the specific landscapes, such as I'm not. And so I'm kind of taking the music at complete face value then. And as I just said, I open the audio file. I don't look at the score until the second listen. It was kind of ominous. Yeah, it was almost uncanny. It was like an in-between feeling. It wasn't, when I say ominous has a bad connotation. It's not that it was scary, and but it was almost uncanny, really, some of it, and the tremolos and the marimba, especially, it adds to the glassy element, and especially when you're wearing a nice piece of a nice pair of headphones, you can like hear the oscillations. I don't even know if they're the oscillations in particular, but it feels like you're stuck in a sound wave that's reverberating. I just was,
Which you kind of are. I mean, I love a low rolling marimba. It's just this chocolatey, beautiful sound. And so there's the marimba and vibraphone both rolling a lot, and there's some bowed vibraphone and crotales and a bass drum that kind of keeps things also a little bit ominous in a way too. But it's also it has beautiful elements like the glockenspiel as well that kind of add a little sparkle. And I should say this movement has been arranged for a lot of different configurations as well. The marimba player from the trio asked me to make it just alone, like the marimba part on its own stands out very nicely as a marimba solo, and he asked me to edit just slightly so he could play it as a solo. And then it's also been made into a marimba duet and a large mallet ensemble arrangement for I think it's like 12 players, I want to say, and for chamber orchestra. People keep asking me to make it for different things. And actually, somebody asked me to make an arrangement for winds, and I declined because I just didn't think that that would work very well. But
Yeah, I don't know how you would do that, really.
it would be very different, and I don't think as effective. But yeah, it has kind of people have been drawn to it.
No, it's, I really am fascinated by music that has that kind of tone because, as I said, it's kind of an in between. you and what I, at least in my opinion, what that means is that you can take from it what you will and your own interpretation almost. Like, is it on the weirder side, more uncanny side, more positive side? So, no, it's absolutely beautiful, and congratulations on the success of that movement in
Thanks.
particular.
Yeah.
But so, certainly when you're learning composition, what I know in my limited knowledge at least is the rules of contrasts, especially when you're doing a multi-movement work. And certainly you illustrated that to the heart with the beginning of movement three, which is titled Solana for the Solana State Forest. It is significantly fiery, much more fiery than the first two movements, and it is quite the whiplash, especially at the beginning, from the second movement. If you were at all feeling at ease or comfortable or melancholy from the first two, whipped right out of you at the beginning. So, can you talk a bit about Solana, the inspiration, and putting it together?
Yeah, so Solana is in central Minnesota, and it's a deciduous forest.
What does that
And
mean? What does deciduous mean?
so deciduous is trees with leaves that fall rather than like a pine tree. That's
Okay.
the difference between the two. And there are a few pine trees and tamarack trees there, but it's mostly deciduous, hardwoods. And there's a lot of life there. I think this is a bit like major example of the fact that nature isn't always quiet. We think of nature as being just like serene and beautiful, and it's just like you go for the solitude and the silence. But actually, sometimes there's a lot of noise going on. Like there's a cacophony of birds sometimes, and that opening is actually the drumming of a ruffed grouse. It's supposed to sound a bit like that, which is a really fascinating sound. You can hear it in that forest. The male ruffed grouse like pumps their wings and makes this drumming sound with the air beneath their wings as like a mating call. And it's really quite loud and fascinating and distinctive as well to listen to.
Sure. And an exceptionally unique element of this piece or this movement, and the ones coming up, but it starts here, flower pots. You use flower pots. So, I'm not going to ask it fancy. Why? Why flower pots?
So, well, for one thing, flower pots actually in the percussion world are not particularly uncommon.
Really?
So like it on surface level from like the standpoint of somebody who's not a percussionist, you might think that's a little weird. And yes, they might have had to go to the hardware store, but guaranteed they had played on flower pots before.
Are
And
they
sometimes there's
terracotta?
a Yeah, they're clay terracotta flower pots, and they have a very earthy sound, which is like kind of the draw for me is it's not a drum, it's not wood, it's like it's somewhere in between and has this very earthy, and especially in the next movement, which we'll get to, is actually where I decided I needed those flower pots because of the rock in that landscape in Blue Mounds, which we'll talk about next. But I also felt like it fit in here with the various sounds I heard at Solana, but also for a practical standpoint, there's a lot of instruments, but I still wanted to keep a little bit of a cap on it. So like I have these flower pots, I can use them in both pieces rather than bringing in a totally new instrument. And I did think that the clay sound really worked here.
I'm gonna say an oxymoron to describe them. There's like a dulled sharpness, which the dulled part, the dulled is the earthiness, and because the ting, they're easy to be heard, So, in music, we like our oxymorons, so dulled sharpness. But so yeah, let's talk about the next movement, which is movement four, which is titled Blue Mounds for the Blue Mounds State Park. Before we get to the further spotlighting of the terracotta pots, let's talk about another auxiliary element. And please tell me if this is common in the percussion world. Newspaper. You
No,
use
not as common.
newspaper. Okay. So I'm not too out of the loop, but
I'm
it,
sure I'm
yeah.
not the first. I'm definitely not the first, but it's not a common. And also, it was kind of funny. So the piece, I'll just start by telling you a little bit about the movement and then a little bit more about the newspaper as well. But so Blue Mound State Park is a prairie, essentially. And when we think of nature in Minnesota, a lot of times we think of the North Woods and the North Shore and, forest. But actually, the like bottom third of the state was at one time tall grass prairie. And there's not much of it left. So this is kind of just like a little segment. And you kind of have to use your imagination when you're there because it's surrounded by cornfields. And you kind of think, okay, think about what this was like hundreds of years ago when it was all this grass that I'm sitting in right now. And beneath the grass is quartzite. It's a actually very desirable stone which was mined in this area long ago, and you can see the mining site at Blue Mound State Park. But as you're hiking like through these grasslands, you're constantly seeing patches of this quartzite too, and that is what really I wanted to bring out with the terracotta pots, is that rock that you're standing on and stepping on, and it does make a distinct sound when you stomp on it with your hiking boots. But also, you mentioned that it's kind of feels like it's a slow burn, and like so On surface level, a prairie is kind of almost feels like desolate. It's just like breezy, windy, soft, like a sea of grass sounding. But when you really start to study what's there in that ecosystem, it's really fascinating. There's just like a lot more underground than you realize. The roots of the prairie grass go down like meters and meters. It's really fascinating. And the turnover of the grasses as well, and how like bison, for example, are really integral to the health of the prairie. And so the newspaper element is supposed to sound like wind. Drifting wind. And I think the one thing, so I just put newspaper in there, and the percussionist playing the newspaper kind of crumples it up and rubs it along either a table or the floor. And this percussionist did use the floor, which has kind of a visual element for the audience that is kind of fun too. But he had been using like the same piece of newspaper to rehearse and practice, and it was like it had gotten to be so soft that it was like barely making a sound. It was like, no, this needs to be a fresh newspaper. Show me the date on the newspaper that it's from today, you know. And so that made it a different sound as well.
Very fascinating. And yeah, as you mentioned in the notes that I sent to you, the movement, as opposed to the other ones, there's a textural development in all of them in different ways, but this one particularly felt like a slower burn, where it started off slower and became more dynamic as it went on. And to connect thematically with what you're talking about, I gave you a measure when I thought it started transforming at measure 37, but discovering the more intimate details of a prairie environment, as you're saying. And again, as someone who's not familiar with that kind of landscape, other than driving through, I don't think I've ever really been to one. It's a very foreign kind of environment, and it's fascinating to think about what happens above just the normal gaze, which someone like myself would only be familiar with, and then yourself, of course, with the more detailed. So, all very cool, all very cool. And honestly, out of all the things that I've heard or seen of in modern composition or even percussion, newspaper's not too wild. So,
No, it's not.
I mean, we use thunder sheets. It's basically like a different kind
Right.
of, yeah. So, yeah, let's move on to the final movement, which is, oh, can you help me with the pronunciation?
Yeah, Itasca.
Itasca. Yes.
So it's a state. Itasca State Park is in the northwest corner of the state, and it's most famous for being the headwaters of the Mississippi River. So it starts with a trickle, and you can kind of hear that. It starts with just this little, very quiet, soft little motion that starts trickling down and then builds as the river widens. And I don't feel like this piece gets all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. But it does get further south through Minnesota as the river builds.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that's the general idea of the piece is that it's starting it starts at Lake Itasca, and you can actually walk across the rocks that are like the edge of Lake Itasca, and then the water trickles out and becomes the Mississippi River.
That's really, really cool. And, you know, I, you know, a little divergent question. If someone was from Minnesota, would they know all of these different parks? Like, are these all pretty well known?
Some yes, some no. I think most, I mean, everybody knows the North Shore. So Superior, for example, hits home to a lot of people. I mean, everybody in Minnesota is at least familiar with that, what that either looks like or they have been there. If they haven't been there, they at least understand what it's going to be like. Itasca is definitely, I'd say, our most famous state park, and most people in Minnesota would know, oh yeah, the Mississippi River headwaters. Solana, no, nobody knows what that is. But they do understand like what a deciduous forest is, and then can identify with that. Voyageurs National Park, a lot of people don't know that we even have a national park, and that's partly because we also have the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, which is a very similar landscape and is a little bit more well known. And that's a canoeing only landscape. Whereas at Voyageurs, you can use motorized boats. That might be the big, and the lakes are larger, which like canoeing on them wouldn't always be the best idea. And then the Blue Mounds State Park, well, a lot of people know about Blue Mounds. That one's not super obscure.
I was just wondering about that. And, you know, because so talking about Itasca, the last one. Being the top of the Mississippi River, that's pretty significant geographically. Just I don't know if it is it the largest river in the United States? I don't know.
I believe so.
Yes, or you know, quite frankly, it's probably the most significant river in terms of like our psychology. If you ask someone big river in the United States, they'll probably say the Mississippi River. At least if they're on the Midwest to the East Coast, they would say that. But you know, I'm thinking about, and you know, this is a question I put in what I sent to you, the ordering of the movements, because for the most part, you have five character pieces to like boil it down to something standard nomenclature. And you've kind of already answered, or I kind of already understand why you put Itasca last, because it is the most grand in concept. At least, you know, the top of the Mississippi River, that's a really big deal geographically. And just to think about that and like the start of what can be a very, very long and storied journey, it makes sense why you put that one last. But I'm just want, you know, just I want to pick your brain on your thoughts on what you were thinking about when you were ordering the pieces. Was it just purely aurally, like, okay, this one works in contrast with this one, this one's a good opener? And like placing the different parks next to each other.
Sure. So, in one sense, yes, like musically, the way the piece unfolds had a lot to do with it, like having the way they unfold musically. It just makes sense the way they're laid out. But also I talked about Voyagers being like a waking up for the day kind of piece. The forest unfolding or the landscape waking up. And so that made sense to be first. And I think the kind of joyous and, build of Itasca made it sound good at the end. And the middle ones, I think, were more like, this is just the best order for them. I don't know that there was, I didn't think about that necessarily at the beginning of writing the piece, like what order they were in. And I didn't write them in the order that they are in. When they're performed, I don't exactly remember the particular order I wrote them in, but it wasn't one, two, three, four, five. And that's just kind of, it was an after the fact decision, I think, that kind of unfolded as it went.
Sure. I'm always interested in those sort of things when looking at multi-movement works, especially when they are begging you to recollect on real things. So Always wondering, there doesn't always need to be a specific scientific answer, or
Sure.
sometimes it just works. Sometimes it just works. So, we've gone through step by step, the landscape of the state of Minnesota, which is really cool. I can see why you used or went with the grant with this piece because it's well, as someone who's not from Minnesota, it feels very representative. You've been saying, we're going up to this part of the state, we're going to this part of the state, and some history about it. I did not know that there were prairies in southern Minnesota at any time. I just, quite frankly, I think of Minnesota as a frozen tundra.
It
Yes. But hope and wish to visit that part of the country at some point. Again, I'm sure at least visit at some point in the country, the Dakotas, Iowa, northern Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and so on. But so we've come to the end of this like narrative retelling of this piece, which I always love those sort of things, being able to tell a story along the way. Atmospherically as well. But is there anything else that you want to say about Land of Cloud-Tinted Water before we move on?
I think the thing that this conversation has kind of brought up for me is that I think some of the landscapes can be imagined a bit, even if you haven't been there. And I think that that's really kind of what it's all about is awareness of the landscapes and whether it be encouraging people to visit them or just to be respectful of them and appreciate them is kind of the whole meaning behind landscape music in itself. So, yeah.
Sure. Certainly. And, for literally the majority of us, probably, who have never been to Minnesota or all these parks, we are certainly imagining them alongside what you're writing. So that certainly is achieved. So now we've come to the last part of this podcast, or the last third, where we get a little bit more general. And so I'm going to start with the beautifully broad question, and you can take this in any way that you want. What does music, maybe even composition, mean to you?
Yeah, so I just think it's very simple. Music is communication. And for me, it's my most authentic way of communicating or telling a story, setting a scene. Emulating or evoking feelings, describing events. And I think it's as simple as that. You're having a relationship with your audience, the players, and creating a community and communicating.
Sure. Yeah, sometimes it can just be that simply put, and that can mean a lot of different things in your life. And so I'm interested to hear your thoughts. So that's music, that's composition, and that's your station in life for the most part, as far as we all know and need to know, unless if you want to share. But so let's flip it around to what is another part of this podcast, which is music theory. When I say that, when I ask that, a lot of people have very different conceptions. Most of the time, it's for good reason, whether they're good or bad perceptions. But I'm just interested, when I say music theory, when you think of that, what does that mean?
I honestly don't think a lot about music theory when I'm writing. I sometimes, after I've written something, I might take a closer look and think, oh, okay, I did this. I chose to write in this key, but I wasn't really thinking about it in advance. I was just writing what came to me. And I think about theory a lot more when I'm writing for young musicians because it's important to make sure you're writing in an accessible key, for example, and making sure that, it's within the bounds of the player's ability. And I think that creates just a need to think about it a little bit more, but especially a piece like this, like Land of Cloud-Tinted Water, I really am just going to evoke the mood of the piece and the meaning behind it. And it's kind of fun to analyze afterwards, but it's not at the forefront of my mind when I'm writing.
Sure. And so what was your experience when going through, now you hadn't really spoken about it before, but going through your own formal education, how did theory, in fact, we all have to do it. It's like, you know, when I explain to my parents, to friends and so on, like, what do I do? You know, there's a couple ways to simply explain music theory, but one of the most common ones that I do, it's like how even if you're a completely native English speaker, we're all musicians going into college, hopefully, you still have to take an English class. You still have to like understand the fundamentals of your language, regardless if you know how to speak it very well. And I see music theory similarly. You know, you might be able to.
Totally.
Might be able to play perfectly like a premier concerto player, but you need to understand how chord to chord, given, you know, it depends on what a student wants to do, but that's the basic premise. You know, what was your relationship in your education, to it? Was it just a tool that let you go further, or was it anything else?
I think that at the time I wasn't, my first and second year of college taking theory, I wasn't necessarily interested in it beyond like, oh, this is a required course. And like I understood these are the building blocks of music and of especially from a historical standpoint, like I didn't think about it in like a real sense of composition. Because there were so many rules. And I feel like at this point in composition, we have thrown out most of those rules, but it's important to understand where they came from and the context that they bring to music now that's being written. And sometimes, some of those rules are still there in some people's music and in other works, maybe they're not. But I think it's important to understand them. And I can appreciate that more now than I maybe did at the time.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, as you know, as I've said, I'm 23. I'm in my second year of graduate school, so I'm kind of like asking you to reflect on where you would have been, you know, mentally, where I am right now. And you know, perspectives change over time. And I've realized, you know, I'm a music theory graduate student, and my relationship theory is a little bit different than yours, of course. It's the name of my degree and deal with it a lot more and go into a lot. Oh my gosh, weeds is not even the right way to describe it. It's like the minerals in the soil, honestly, not even just the weeds. But, you know, I've thought about, I have a very different, the way that I think about theory than I did in my undergrad and I do now. And I've reflected on that. Why is that? And I realized that a big part of it, you know, different instructors, different people, different influences, but all of my undergrad instructors in theory were composers. And looking back on that, I appreciate that every single day. For many reasons. And one of them was that, like, okay, maybe this isn't the finest pedagogy on the planet, but early in undergrad, when we got a voice leading assignment, you know, write a four-part harmony, it might as well have been it. I mean, there were rules and things to follow, just as you're saying, but it felt so much fun because it was basically a composition assignment. Here's a set of guidelines. Make something out of it. And it was so much bloody fun. And is that the best way to teach every undergrad? Maybe not. But I, and one of my favorite classes I've ever taken was 15th, 16th century counterpoint, a modal counterpoint, learning the very strict rules of Palestrina. While that's true, one of our first major assignments in that class, which was taught by Dr. Paul Richards, professor of composition at University of Florida, was to write a three-part motet. You know, just that kind of music theory experience being coupled with composition, I now look back and I appreciate, even though it was just a couple of years ago, I appreciate that so immensely much because I, you know, I'm developing as a person, how I think, how I teach, but the more that I go through, the more I look back and experience new things, composition is so important to theory. And, you know, theory is obviously important to composition. You need it on some fundamental level. But I real just the joy in music theory, in a way, comes from composition in many ways.
Yeah, I'd say you're very lucky to have had that experience. Not every theory professor goes at it from that perspective of making composition part of the learning process. And I feel like I didn't quite get that in, the way I was being taught theory. It was more about the rules and like identifying chords and chord changes and things, which isn't as much fun as like, here's the rules, now create something with it. So I think that's really awesome.
Oh, it, yeah. And it, you have the significantly more typical experience. And I'm not saying that it's bad, but it's, I just think that it's very freeing, especially for undergrads who are intentional, who want to go into higher academia or higher like study of more advanced musics and so on. And, you know, for example, earlier on, you said that a good deal of your influences, you can, if you're going to pick an era or a type, minimalism, you know, and post-minimalism. You know, it being taught by people with compositional mindsets, it's not just having them or having your students compose, but you know what? people who know me know that I'm calling out specific things here, but that also means that when I was growing up in a theoretical in my theory, I wasn't just looking at mid to late Baroque and early classical music. You know, that mean, you know, I was understanding the theoretical stylistic hallmarks of minimalism and postminimalism. If you wanted to imitate that composition, what would you do? And, you know, so this, we're kind of going back and forth about, and I'm kind of preaching about some of my experiences here, but this is to ask you, you know, we've been kind of answering this, but to ask it directly, how could music theory and composition better co-mingle in an educational and then professional environment?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think what you've described in the way that you were taught theory is like a perfect example of that in understanding that theory didn't end like 200 years ago, that it's still relevant today is like a good first step because it really felt a bit irrelevant to me at, when I was a freshman and sophomore in college. I mean, I understood why it was important, but it felt like it wasn't being used anymore. And that was like consistently being told, like, this rule doesn't apply anymore, but let's learn it anyway. And that made it seem like it wasn't something that was, relevant anymore. So making it known that it is still making an impact on composers today. And it makes much more of an impact than I realize. It's just like ingrained. It's not something that I'm necessarily analyzing while composing, but it's core to my musical upbringing, like Western classical music, and it's just part of it. And so finding ways to connect those things in that way to what's happening now is a great start.
It certainly is a great start. None of this has an easy answer. If it did, someone would have written a doctoral thesis on it 30 years ago and solved it all. So, you know, probably even further back than that. So it's all working towards the goal. So since we still have a little bit of time, this is not necessarily in line with this, but I teased this earlier. I do want to talk about, you know, the differences of attitudes in composing for, let's say, middle school, high school, or maybe a collegiate level, maybe lower collegiate level. And then, like the quote unquote big professional world. What are your experiences in that, writing for both, being in both?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely a stigma, if you will, like if you're a composer who writes just for young band that or whatever ensemble, like young orchestra too, young piano, that the music isn't serious and it's just like it's only about trying to teach somebody how to play the instrument, and sometimes it doesn't even do that. It just has to be easy. But you know what? Easy music is really hard to write because you have so many boundaries. It has to be playable by someone who is new at music, at their instrument, or just isn't at a level that they can do whatever you put on the page. And of course, there's limitations even when you're writing for professionals, but there's a lot more limitations when you're writing for young players and for groups of young players, because then it has to be something that everybody can, approach with their different instruments and so forth, which takes a lot more thought and nuance than I think people realize sometimes. So I think that does re deserve some respect. But I think for me personally, as a composer, I want to have it both ways. I also, like the piece we talked about today is clearly for professional musicians. It's not playable by beginners in the least. And that is a piece that I was really able to express myself in whatever way I saw fit to a point, but it like the music that when you write for young people, it's much less about your personal expression as a composer and more as a community or group project or collaboration between the composer and the musicians themselves.
I think that absolutely beautifully put. And I think that's where the rubber meets the road, is that last part, is the some people's inability or unwanting to compromise. But
Sure. Yeah.
yeah, I don't have anything else to add. You put that beautifully. Well, thank you for diving into that little side thing. And man, we could keep going on about a whole bunch of different host of topics,
We could.
but we're coming to the end here. This has been a great conversation. I feel like I've done a little intro guide to the state of Minnesota and the natural landscape, which is absolutely wonderful. And we went into some topics that are, at least me in academia, daily occurrences, and certainly things that affect your own personal sphere. But Catherine, I'm sure you've got a whole host of things going on. But what are some big projects that are on the horizon for you?
Sure, I have recently completed a different percussion piece for 12 players, if for Prior Lake High School Percussion Ensemble, and they're performing it at the Midwest Clinic in December in Chicago, and that's a very large international band and orchestra convention, if you're familiar. So that's really exciting because it's kind of a big stage, and they're a really, really outstanding high school group, and I was excited to be able to work with them again because I have written a couple other pieces for them. And I also have two high school band pieces. So I had like three high school level pieces in a row, which in a way kind of feels strange to be on one level, multiple pieces in a row, but also kind of lets you live there for a while. So that works out just fine.
Sure. Some exciting premieres and performances coming up. That's always great to hear. And so, what would be the best way for the audience to reach you with any comments, questions, or inquiries?
You can get in touch on my website and the contact page. You can find me there, and I'm also on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Katherine Bergman. You can find me on the internet.
Awesome. And of course, to everyone listening, all of those links will be in the description of this episode, regardless of where you're listening. And it will also be on Catherine's contributor page on our host website. So we are actually at the end now. And I always like to ask this general question for you to give some kind of takeaway. You're to say anything to the audience about music, life, composition, anything in general. What would that be?
I think the one thing that's really cool about new music today is that there's so much variety. It's one of the few times in music history that it's like acceptable to write whatever style or genre you like, and you can write something in a major key and still be taken seriously. in many aspects. So I think that just leads to saying go and explore and listen to lots of different things. And I feel like I don't spend enough time doing that. So that's something I'm always trying to strive for, and I encourage others to do the same.
Beautiful. I love it. Go and explore. Fits with the theme of the different natural settings. Well, Catherine, this has been a fantastic time and conversation. I thank you for coming on to the Theorist Composer collaboration, for sharing your piece, Land of Cloud-Tinted Water. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Aaron again. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to Catherine Bergman for coming onto the podcast and for sharing her piece, Land of Cloud-Tinted Waters. Catherine's contact info is listed in the description, and I would appreciate it if you could show her some support. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer Collaboration, make sure to follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. You can listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. If you want to monetarily support the work of the TCC, you can click the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page. All donations are highly appreciated. All of the relevant links to follow, listen to, and support the show are in the description. TCC episodes are posted every other week on Mondays, and don't miss our blog posts, which go live a few days after a new episode is added. Make sure to follow our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms because you won't want to miss any of this wonderful content or new episodes. But until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.